Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco at 110 Embarcadero, the Commonwealth Club's new home. And I'd like to also welcome our online and radio audience. It's my pleasure to introduce Sasha Polakow-Saransky today, the author of Go Back to Where You Came From. He has been a contributor in The Guardian, Foreign Policy, Newsweek, New Republic, Boston Globe, and he has looked into the immigration issue and why it is that people are reacting as strongly as they are. Of course, there's a lot of history behind this at other times, but why now, when everyone thought liberal democracy was so well established, that we're going back to the same problems we had before? Thank you very much for coming, Sasha.
Thanks very much. Thanks to everyone for coming. I have two copies of my book up here, so I don't really know what to do with it. But so I'd like to tell you a little bit about the central arguments of this book and also try to draw some parallels between what we've seen in the past 2 years in European countries and what is happening in this country. I began the research for this book in the summer of 2015. I had written a grant application to the Open Society Foundations to get some support for some journalistic research as I left the New York Times op-ed page and tried to embark on the reporting for this book. At that moment, I had no idea what was about to hit in Europe. There were already trends that you could see. I had a sense that a new political movement was brewing. There were already far-right politicians who were present, who were trying to stoke resentment of immigrants and refugees. But what happened in mid-2015 and in the fall of 2015 changed everything. And those politicians needed a catalyst, and they got it from the refugee crisis and the hundreds of thousands, over a million Syrian refugees coming in to Europe during those months in the summer of 2015. And I just want to read you a short passage from the book to give you a sense of the situation on the ground in August 2015, the first few weeks that I was doing reporting for this book. In the middle of the afternoon on August 25th, 2015, as most of Germany was enjoying the end of the summer holidays, a small government agency posted a message on Twitter that would shape the fate of hundreds of thousands of Syrians and millions of Germans. "We are at present largely no longer enforcing Dublin procedures for Syrian citizens," read the seemingly unspectacular bureaucratic tweet posted by the Federal Office for Migration and Refugees. But it meant something very different for the hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants streaming through Turkey and seeking a way into Europe. A few days after the German announcement, a steady flow of Syrians, Afghans, Iraqis, and others began to arrive on the Greek island of Kos. As tanned Dutch tourists dodged refugee children wandering through the bike lanes, a middle-aged Syrian man showed me a screenshot of his itinerary on a tattered Samsung smartphone. A squiggly line snaked through a poorly drawn map of Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, and Hungary, with the prices of each point-to-point journey listed in dollars. The shortest and most treacherous, from Turkey to Kos, cost $1,500. The hydrofoil fare for those blessed with visas and the right passports was $16. If they made it across alive, the wary refugees, many of them from Syria, would then trudge 2 miles past backpacker bars and package deal hotels, passing occasional British revelers on the way home from a long night of drinking. They would arrive at the still-shuttered Kos police station before dawn, and then they'd wait. It was there that I met Mohammed, a 16-year-old from the Syrian city of Latakia, who had made the journey from Turkey on a small dinghy with 21 others after the German announcement. He had been living in a tent on Kos's trash-strewn beach for a week. His companions, 20-year-old Hatem and 22-year-old Mahmoud, came from the Syrian cities of Deir ez-Zor and Hama, where some of the earliest protests against the Assad regime began in 2011. One bears a scar where he was shot through the knee. The other fled to Jordan, where he was beaten by police before escaping to Turkey. Greek Coast Guard boats rescued their vessel halfway to Kos and brought them ashore. The next day, the three men took an overnight ferry to Athens with hundreds of other Syrians. As word spread that Germany was opening its doors, odes to Chancellor Angela Merkel appeared on Facebook in Arabic, praising her as a loving mother and a lion. By the end of the week, Mohammed had written to me to say that he'd reached the Austrian-German border. "I don't know anyone in Hamburg," he told me in a text message. But Germany had announced it would accept 500,000 refugees, so he crossed and took a train north. So that was the first week of my reporting for this book. And as I said, the Syrian refugee crisis and this influx of people into Europe was a catalyst, and it was also a great gift for these far-right politicians. People like Marine Le Pen, Geert Wilders, and the new AfD party in Germany, they couldn't have imagined a greater political gift than that number of people coming in, because as they were already seeking to stoke the fears of voters who were angry about immigration, suddenly they could say that there was a mass influx of Muslims who were coming to transform and take over their civilization. And this is the kind of rhetoric that we started to see. And one of the key themes in this book is the way that these politicians exploited the refugee crisis and leveraged fear as a political tool. There were legitimate concerns about immigration. There were flaws in Europe's immigration policies and integration policies. In a lot of these countries, large numbers of people had come over the years. The government's integration policies hadn't been particularly effective. There had been terrorist attacks. There had also been tension between Turkish and Moroccan communities in places like Holland and the people who had been living in those neighborhoods before. But what these politicians did very effectively is they managed to foment fear and to scapegoat all immigrants and all refugees, and also to conflate terrorists and refugees in a way that painted desperate Syrians fleeing ISIS as if they were somehow ISIS members who were coming to destroy Europe. And despite the fact that this was not true, it worked very effectively in political campaigns over the past 2 years. And so when you talk to a lot of people, as I did in the reporting for this book, they'll say, oh, two or three of them among the hundreds of thousands are actual refugees, but most of them are just terrorists trying to get into Europe. Or they'll say, they're all economic migrants. And there's a grain of truth to that argument in the sense that there were people from Pakistan and Bangladesh and countries like that seeking a better life and a better economic future in Europe. But there were also hundreds of thousands of genuine refugees, mostly Syrian, but also from places like Afghanistan and Iraq. And so one of the things that I noticed as I was reporting for this is that the grievances that I heard from these far-right voters, one of the main ones was that the left had ignored them. They would say, I used to vote for the Communist Party in France, or I used to vote for the Labour Party in Holland, or the Social Democrats in Denmark. And they felt that those politicians had not been listening to them. They felt that those politicians had not done anything for them. And so they moved from the center-left and the far-left to the far-right. And what you saw then, as the far-right started to gain these voters, is they started to cave in or adopt the policy agenda of far-right politicians. So you see in a place like Denmark, the Social Democratic Party starting to take a very hard line on immigration because they're so afraid of losing even more voters to the Danish People's Party. The Dutch Labour Party was completely decimated in the last election in Holland, going from being one of the largest parties in the country to fewer than 10 seats out of 150 in parliament. And those votes have gone to the far right. Some of them have gone to the Green Party and the left. But what these far right parties did is they forced everyone in their direction on the question of immigration. And what that has done is it's created a sort of new normal in European politics, where everyone is so afraid of losing votes to them that they cave in, adopt their agenda. And so even if these parties don't win, their ideas win. Their ideas become the new normal, and that then sets the agenda and becomes the center of debate in these countries. Another one of the key themes in this book, and one of the most worrying trends that I saw, is the notion of civilizational war that far-right politicians have brought right to the forefront of political debate. And they argue that Muslims are coming en masse and colonizing or counter-colonizing Europe. And they actually use the rhetoric of colonialism. They say they are coming to take us over and transform our societies irrevocably and forever. And we can't let any refugees in. We can't let any more immigrants, if they're from Muslim countries, in, because they are going to bring their values and their religion. And there's also a sort of social Darwinist rhetoric linked with this sometimes that is, it's an argument that says, oh, and they're also having tons and tons of babies, and they're outproducing us, and they're a demographic time bomb. And if we keep letting them in, and they keep having babies at a higher rate than Germans or Danes, we will be overtaken, and in 10 or 20 years, our children will be speaking Arabic or Turkish and not German. Now, if you look at the actual data, this is nonsense. Most countries show a convergence between immigrant groups and native groups after about a generation, largely due to housing costs and other very practical matters. It's true that at a certain point in the 70s and 80s, Turkish mothers in Germany were having more children than German mothers, but there's largely been a convergence in most of these places. So this kind of rhetoric is an alarmist rhetoric, but it's also gaining a lot of currency with voters who don't necessarily go and look at population data. They listen to politicians who are often well-spoken, convincing, and seem to be reflecting their anger and their fears. I think another part of this civilizational war rhetoric that we see comes from the post 9/11 moment in American politics and European politics. If you recall, in the late 90s, yes, there was some Islamophobia. Yes, there was hostility to immigrants in all of these countries. In Europe, there were a lot of Muslim refugees from Bosnia in the mid and late 90s who went to countries like Germany and Holland. And people were resentful in some cases, felt people were taking the new immigrants were and refugees were taking their jobs. But you didn't hear this Islamic threat rhetoric. That started after 9/11. And I think the other thing that I've seen that's quite worrying in countries like France is there's a recycling of an old form of nationalism and an old rhetoric that in the 19th century and in the 1930s was used to target Jews. And that rhetoric has been repurposed and grafted onto a new target. And now the target, the other, is Muslims. And so if you look at some of the statements, and this goes for newspaper journalists, editorialists, philosophers, but also some of the writers who've inspired the French right, it's exactly the same kind of thing that was said during the Dreyfus Affair about Jews in France, that this is a foreign body, this is an other that is polluting the pure blood of the nation. The exact same ideas are being used. And what's most disturbing in some cases is that there actually are prominent French Jewish intellectuals, some of whom are the children of Holocaust survivors, who've gone in with this rhetoric and in some cases have actually parroted this rhetoric and used it to target Muslims in France because they feel threatened by Muslim immigrants in France, but they're actually employing the logic that was used against Jews a century ago. The other idea that is central in the debate in France is this notion of the great replacement. And you may have heard a similar phrase in Charlottesville a couple of months ago. The white nationalists who were marching through Charlottesville were chanting, "They will not replace us, and the Jews will not replace us." Now, this has a direct antecedent in French far-right literature and philosophy. There is a writer named Renaud Camus who wrote a book called The Great Replacement that has become so popular in far-right circles that even guys on the street who I met sitting in a park in Calais in northern France who were organizing anti-immigrant demonstrations would quote from this 2,000-page book written by a fairly obscure but now quite prominent French philosopher. And the basic logic of it is the same as the counter-colonization argument. It is that these people are coming, they are reproducing at a faster rate, and within a generation, France will no longer exist because, in their view, France is a nation based on blood and soil. It's not a civic community, in their view. And so it's a revival of ethnic nationalism that most Europeans thought had been banished after World War II. And these ideas are now being imported across the Atlantic, and the same sort of ideas and the same sort of rhetoric is being picked up by white nationalist groups in Charlottesville. In Gainesville, Florida, just last week, we saw a rally where Richard Spencer was speaking and some of his supporters firing into a crowd of protesters. So these are people who are violent and are trying to revive very dangerous ideas, but they're also cross-pollinating. And that's what I find interesting and disturbing, is that there is a dialogue going on across the Atlantic and between far-right parties in Europe. And even if it's not explicit, the ideas are moving and being taken up because they're convenient for people who are trying to target immigrants and refugees and scapegoat them for all of the nation's problems, whether it's in France or the United States. Another key finding in my book that I think is essential if the left in any of these countries is going to fight back against these parties, is that they have rebranded themselves. So there's a tendency on the left and among my own friends and family to say, oh, Marine Le Pen, she's just like her father. She's an unreconstructed fascist. And this new German party, they're nothing but a revival of the Nazi party. And it's actually not quite so simple, because part of the reason that they've been so effective in the last 2 to 3 years is that they've explicitly tried to distance themselves from that legacy. And so what you see now is Marine Le Pen making what she called de-demonization a centerpiece of her campaign and publicly purging some of the people associated with her father. They're also making a direct appeal to constituencies that never would have voted for these people before. So they have made direct appeals to gay voters, to feminists, to Jews. And the argument is that Islam is the greatest threat to all of you, and therefore we will protect you. You should vote for us. And so the result has been that constituencies that used to vote for far-left parties are now going to the far right. And this rebranding has been coupled with a very savvy economic policy agenda that has basically kept the nativist, xenophobic rhetoric that they've always had on the far right in Europe, and they've combined it with an economic policy that in many ways is more socialist than the socialists. And so rather than attacking the welfare state, rather than pushing a neoliberal economic agenda of tax cuts and benefit cuts, far right parties in Europe, and this includes Marine Le Pen in France, they have essentially argued for what I call a nativist nanny state. They are defending the welfare state. They say, we like our excellent health care. We like our free child care. We like our post-secondary education that's often free in countries like Denmark and Holland. And we want to keep it, but for us. We want more welfare. We want to defend care for elderly people, but for us and not for them, for no one else. And what they've done very effectively because of this is they've managed to draw in voters who used to vote for the Communist Party, for Social Democrats, and for Labor parties in many of these countries. And as I sort of get close to wrapping up, I just want to read you a few passages to give you a sense in their own words of how these politicians are articulating this economic message. Because I spent time with Marine Le Pen, and I talked to her quite extensively about this, and I found that if you didn't put a name on the quote, you might think that you were talking to Bernie Sanders, listening to some of what she was saying. So I'm just going to read you a couple of short passages, and then soon I'd like to take your questions. In the post-industrial French town of Ayange, the mayor is a 38-year-old gay vegetarian who used to be a left-wing activist with a group called Workers' Struggle. Things have changed. Now the young mayor, Fabien Engelmann, fears the Great Replacement and views halal meat as a harbinger of Islamization. Despite his own diet, Engelmann sees the absence of pork as truly worrying, a conquest of France through its dishes, he said. Whether or not there's an ethnic or culinary Great Replacement happening in France, it's unquestionably happening in politics. In France's post-industrial North and East, uneducated working-class people whom the left once saw as its base now vote for Le Pen. With Le Pen having discarded the image of fascists and skinheads, ex-leftists are now at the center of the party's modernization campaign. She tacked to the left in the 2016 campaign, clearly believing that there were more votes to be won from the old left than from Catholic conservatives. Although Le Pen prefers to avoid the phrase welfare state, that's a socialist concept, she told me, she's appealed directly to this yearning for a large, nurturing state that fights for the little guy and not the rich. I defend fraternity, the idea that a developed country should be able to provide the poorest with the minimum needed to live with dignity as a human being. The French state no longer does that, she told me. We're in a world today in which you either defend the interests of the people or the interests of the banks. And she's seen results. She pointed to the 2015 elections at the time of the interview, and she said it was socialist communist for 80 years. I won 45%. A year later, she took 52%. In the 2017 election. So in the same way that Donald Trump swept through the Rust Belt states in this country, places with high union membership that have historically voted Democratic, Le Pen is appealing to traditionally left voters who resent the capitalist class but no longer see socialists as representing their class interests. And she's very effectively used this to draw in voters from the old left. I'll read you another quick passage about how she's tried to leverage this rhetoric to get gays and Jews to vote for her party. If there's a day when it became kosher for gays and Jews to vote for the Front National, it was December 10th, 2010. Le Pen was campaigning for the party leadership and declared in a speech to the party faithful, "I hear more and more firsthand accounts of how in certain neighborhoods it's not good to be a woman or a homosexual or a Jew or even French or white." It wasn't a dog whistle or a subtle reference. She was saying directly to gay voters, "I recognize you're being victimized, and immigrants and Muslims are the cause of your pain." Or as her advisor, Sébastien Chenu, told Le Monde, "Who best protects the weakest? Marine Le Pen. A gay who is attacked for being gay is going to seek a strong law and order platform." And as her inner circle filled with more and more openly gay advisors, she made her pitch to Jewish voters more explicit. "For a lot of French Jews, the FN appears to be the only movement that can defend them from this new anti-Semitism nourished in the banlieue, the suburbs," she told me. "In a very natural way, they have turned towards us because we are capable, I think, of protecting them from that." So there's still a lot of Jews in France who fear the Le Pen family, but the fact that she's actually making that pitch and getting a few of them to vote for her is quite alarming. There's one other character in this book, and I haven't named him because he requested anonymity, but he's a prominent Dutch Jewish political figure who is a huge supporter of the Dutch far-right leader Geert Wilders. And I got to know this person quite well in the course of several interviews, and I found him to be one of the most fascinating and also one of the most terrifying figures because he described a political trajectory to the far right that began in a family that had been almost wiped out in the Holocaust. And to see how that logic worked and brought him to this point, essentially brought him to a point that Le Pen is trying to get Jewish voters in France to reach, is something that I think bears consideration and thought. I'll read you a few quotes from him, and then I'll wrap up. He told me, "It's an outdated reflex for Jews to always say the problem is the extreme right. We have new enemies and we need new ideas. We shouldn't discriminate between the socialist anti-Semites and the right-wing anti-Semites. Jews are always fucked in Europe," he told me. We should go for the short term. It's a historic anomaly that we're not in danger. We should be active and vote for parties that are good for us now. Excuse his strong language. And later on, he said to me, "At this time in history, Jews can't be heroes. I don't think in politics Jews have the luxury of choosing their allies. If I were a Muslim in Europe," he told me, "at this moment, I would be very uneasy. If Europeans regain their manhood, it could be bad. It's the history of Europe to treat foreigners terribly. We Jews know that." And yet, despite that very honest admission, this is the most prominent Jewish supporter of Geert Wilders' far-right party in Holland today. And I think what his story shows is that the longer-term danger in all of these countries is that they could be dismantled from within, and the democratic institutions that make them liberal democracies could be eroded from within by populist politicians who don't really care about judicial independence and constitutional protections or minority rights. In their view, democracy is purely majoritarian. They have a very crude and simple view of democracy, 50% of the vote plus one, and we do whatever we want. That is the vision of a lot of these parties. And when nativist politicians and white nationalist politicians present themselves as defenders of the homeland, they often can garner votes in the way that other extremist parties could not. There's a lot of fear, and you hear this from intellectuals on the right, that jihadists are the real threat. And they are a threat to European countries and to this country, and it's a threat that should be addressed. But what that argument neglects is that no one is going to vote for the Muslim Brotherhood or more extreme Islamist parties like Hizb ut-Tahrir in countries like the UK or Holland or France. Even when they're politically organized, they gain a very small fraction of the vote at all, and they're often not even present in electoral competition. But nativist white nationalist groups are, and they're gaining popularity because they're selling themselves as true native homegrown defenders of European values, even though their political program is often explicitly in contradiction to those liberal democratic values that they claim to defend. And because they have this crude majoritarian view of what democracy should be, the danger, in my view, is that as they gain power and as their ideas become the new normal and their ideas gain power, that we're going to start to see in all of these countries an erosion of the institutions and the constitutional protections that actually make us liberal democracies. And that is something that will happen slowly and from inside, and the threat is from within, not from the outside. And I'll end on that not so uplifting note. Thank you.
All right, it's time for questions, and I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they're listening to Sasha Polakow-Sharansky, the author of Go Back to Where You Came From, speaking about the immigration impasse in Europe and in the United States that's happening as people react to the influx of Muslim refugees. So, first question. And I'd like to apologize for the lights that we have an automatic lighting system that hasn't gotten adjusted yet.
Yeah, it's a bit confused, it seems.
Yeah. It's not enough. I'm motion or something.
Okay.
Thank you for your presentation.
Still. Thank you.
You went into the refugee question a little bit. I was wondering if you saw any direct relation between the terrorist attacks in Nice or in Barcelona or in Paris to having people who wouldn't traditionally never vote for the right making that decision based just on the fear of attacks.
Absolutely. It's hard to pinpoint unless you're interviewing voters in a systematic way, but certainly anecdotally I heard this all the time. And what I noticed especially is the way that the conflation of refugees and terrorists, which has been a major trope in the campaigns of all these parties, was absorbed by voters. They believed it. Even though there's very little evidence that any people coming in, there have been a few cases of, I should acknowledge, where someone who came in the influx of 2015 committed a crime, and they should, of course, be punished just like anyone else who commits such a crime. But the larger political agenda was to combine these two groups, and I think that what's particularly dangerous about this sort of moment is that you have an influx of refugees who belong to the same religious group as people who've committed terrorist attacks. And politicians can very easily blend these two things together, and voters start to identify them as one and the same. And that leads into this kind of civilizational enemy rhetoric that we've seen in all of these places. So I think that nativist politicians probably would have found a way to do this if there were Jews or Buddhists committing terrorist attacks, but it's extremely convenient and extremely dangerous at the moment because the two groups happen to both involve Muslims. And so I think we're going to see more of this. And if, God forbid, there are more terrorist attacks, this rhetoric is going to get amped up. And centrist politicians need to push back against it and remind voters that this is not the same thing. And I think that countries that can prove that they can be relentless in fighting terrorism without collectively punishing Muslim citizens will make great strides and set an example for the rest of Europe. So far, there haven't been many politicians like that. Macron in France is sort of making gestures in that direction and is trying to, and Merkel in Germany has also sort of tried to do this, but it needs to be done much more forcefully.
As you say, it could be any other group. San Francisco has this issue. There's a trial going on right now of the anti-sanctuary cities people. And there was a murder, that a tragic murder on the docks that's being used for the same purpose, but it's anti-Mexican immigrants and has nothing to do with religion or anything like that. It's just the same anti-immigrant issue.
Yeah. This is the case where the bullet ricocheted.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So along those lines, so obviously President Trump adopted and perpetuated the anti-Muslim and Syrian refugee sentiment here in the United States and is being challenged in the travel bans precisely because of those statements. But he also centered his campaign on anti-Mexican rhetoric. So do you see differences between sort of the anti-Muslim versus the anti-Mexican version of this nativism in the United States?
Yeah, there is a distinction. I mean, if we're going to draw parallels between Europe and the U.S., I think that the most obvious parallel with anti-Mexican sentiment would be the pre-2015 resentment of Turks and Moroccans and other Muslims who had come often in the 60s and 70s as guest workers to Europe, and they've stayed, and their families now are in Europe and are often Dutch or German citizens, but they're seen as separate and apart and often resented and scapegoated because parties will argue, oh, they're taking our jobs. And so that is a similar sort of economic form of xenophobia that's much more familiar. Obviously, this country has very few refugees. And so the United States hasn't experienced what Europe experienced on a similar scale, but the idea is politically popular and it's an effective wedge issue. And so Trump combined that, I think, with the pre-existing anti-Mexican sentiment, and it's this sort of fusion of classic economic populist xenophobia and a more sort of hard-edged scapegoating of refugee groups.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
If you widen the landscape, and it's not just Mexicans, but it's really immigrants in general and Muslims in this country. I mean, Trump has encouraged the Republican Party with that native attitude and pushed it more to the right than ever before.
Yes.
So now that you're having congressmen like two congressmen, Flake and you, who have really now, because they're not running for re-election, have started really criticizing him.
Yeah.
So I think, in my opinion, it's not just Mexicans, but it's really immigrants that have been here. And any Muslims are really, in my opinion, in danger with their lives here. So in my sense, there really isn't any difference between the craziness in Europe and the craziness here.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a statement.
Yeah, thank you.
So I think a lot of Trump's rhetoric against anti-immigration and Mexicans specifically caused a chilling effect in the United States of people wanting to come to the United States. And I'm curious whether or not you have an idea of whether it's caused a chilling effect for Muslims going to Europe.
It has on some level. The numbers have also dropped, the refugee numbers. Part of that is a result of EU policies designed to push people back to Turkey or to intercept boats in the Mediterranean heading for Italy. So I think the situations are different in the sense that the U.S. has land borders with many of the countries that immigrants are coming from and are coming up through Central America and into Mexico. Europe is generally harder to reach and involves some sort of journey by boat, and so some of this is enforcement and sort of disincentivizing it because of the way that governments are trying to respond. I think the real question long term is what happens when there's a major climate crisis in a place like, let's say there's a drought in Egypt or half of Bangladesh goes underwater and there's a mass exodus of people from one or both of those countries heading towards Europe. It could be on a far greater scale than the Syrian refugee crisis. And at that point, chilling effects or not, people are going to be desperate and they're going to try to get in. And that is when I fear we could see a much nastier backlash than what we saw in the last 2 years, because the numbers could be greater. And a lot of these populist far-right politicians could be more prominent by then. And like I said at the beginning of the talk, the Syrian refugee crisis of 2015 was a great gift for people like Le Pen. And I can't imagine what she and others would do with another opportunity like that on a larger scale.
Have you looked into the history at all? Like, for example, what you just said about Bangladesh remind me of, say, Ireland and then Italy later, when there was a huge wave of people leaving, just large numbers. And of course, there was a reaction in the United States against it. Did you have any idea? That was all before the 1930s. And therefore, was there a right-wing political reaction during that time?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the Irish famine and anti-Catholic rhetoric in the 19th century in places like Boston, and even in the early 20th century, you know, the origins of the Ku Klux Klan, apart from being a racial terrorist organization, they were focused in the 1920s on killing Catholic priests. They were against Catholic immigration, and that was one of their key mobilizing issues. And so we've seen this before. It was directed at the Irish. It was directed at Italians. It was directed at Jews. There was a lot of anti-Semitic, anti-immigration rhetoric in the mid to late 1930s when German Jewish refugees were desperately trying to get into this country. And you name the other groups. We've seen this before, and the rhetoric is strikingly similar. And you can often just take these quotes and transpose them. And I should also say that it wasn't always purely a right-wing thing. If you look in the late 19th century and in the 20s, some members of the women's suffrage movement engaged in some of this anti-Catholic rhetoric in a way that has echoes of anti-Islamic feminism today, saying these people are coming and destroying our liberal values and the rights of women, and therefore we should keep all of them out. There are precedents for that kind of rhetoric, and there were people writing for magazines like The New Republic and The Nation as late as the 1950s, really up until JFK's victory, denouncing Catholics as a sort of foreign body polluting the nation and endangering it.
With two traditional ideas about women's roles, when you mentioned the women's suffragists, because the Catholics treated their women in a more traditional way, the way the Muslims are said to have done, that was their issue?
Yeah, that was the kind of thing that you heard. And I'm not an expert on this, but it's something that I came across and that I didn't know before doing the research for this. And so, there are echoes. You hear this a lot in Europe now, and there are legitimate complaints about some extremist mosques in Europe and the way that women are treated, and those are serious issues and need to be debated. But it's when that legitimate discussion gets taken a step further and the argument becomes, and therefore we should kick all of them out and not let any more of them in, they're taking us over and polluting the purity of the nation. That crosses a line from legitimate debate into nativist xenophobic propaganda, in my view.
Next question.
In addition to not letting people in, we have a history, and Europe has a history, of incarcerating groups of people, as the Japanese were incarcerated on the West Coast in World War II, but not in Hawaii. Same Japanese, but they weren't a threat in Hawaii, but they were a threat in California and other parts of the West. And that happened as part of the Nazi movement. People were incarcerated and murdered. Do you see that going in that kind of direction in Europe, or are we not at that kind of point?
We're not at that point, and I don't want to be unduly alarmist, but there are worrying ideas out there. And you look at some of these figures on the far right in this country too, people like Sebastian Gorka, who was in the Trump administration until recently, who's a member of a far right anti-Semitic Hungarian group, people like Steve Bannon, who I hear was speaking to the California Republican Party the other day, or will be soon, you know, his favorite novel is this French novel from the 70s called Camp of the Saints, which glorifies the shooting of refugees who are coming to land on the shores of France. It's also one of Marine Le Pen's favorite novels. So, and you heard this in the rhetoric of the new far-right party in Germany, the AfD, when this peaked in September, October 2015. Frauke Petri, who then was the leader of the party and is no longer in that position but still associated with it, said, yes, German police should defend our borders with force and shoot if they need to. And so it's not happening, but the ideas are germinating. Dangerous ideas are present in the public square, and people need to push back against those ideas before they gain greater currency. That's the argument that I'm making. And I will add one thing on the subject of detention camps. You mentioned the internment of Japanese citizens in this country during World War II. What's happening now in Australia is becoming a model for far-right parties in Europe. And I know this sounds a little bit obscure because we don't really talk about Australia much when we talk about immigration crises, but I spent about 6 weeks reporting there because I discovered in talking to Le Pen and the people around Wilders and the Danish People's Party's leadership that they fantasized about creating an immigration policy based on the Australian model, which essentially offshores people who are seeking asylum and puts them in indefinite detention on remote Pacific islands, and then says, you can claim asylum under the UN Refugee Convention, but not here, not in the place you sought to come to and claim asylum. We're going to either turn you back at sea, or we're going to divert you to these remote Pacific islands. And there are Australian-funded and managed detention camps there. And the European far right sees that as a model. And they've said to me, a lot of these leaders explicitly, we would like to pay the Moroccan government or the Tunisian government or the Libyan government, which they actually are paying off already in some ways, to capture and take back migrants between Libya and Italy. They would like to create EU-funded detention camps in North Africa so that refugees seeking to get to Europe never even set foot on European shores, and therefore they would never even have the chance to lodge an asylum claim. So anyone who knows the UN Refugee Convention and the basic ideas behind it, one of the core ideas is called non-refoulement. You don't return people to danger. And what's happening in some of these camps in Australia is people from Afghanistan, Iraq, are going to places like Nauru or Papua New Guinea, being detained indefinitely, and there's been violence from locals against the refugees. And so now there's a question not only of sending people back into danger, but diverting them to a third location where they're exposed to a new danger. And refugee rights activists and human rights lawyers in Australia are extremely concerned about it. What's even more worrying is that this model could be adopted on a larger scale in Europe the next time we see a major crisis.
How long has this Australian policy been in effect?
So it really took off after 2001. The week or a couple of weeks before 9/11, there was a major scandal in Australia when a boat full of refugees somewhere between Indonesia and Australia declared May Day. The people on that boat were rescued by a Norwegian vessel. The Norwegian vessel tried to get into Australian waters, and the Australian government wouldn't allow it, and it turned into a major international scandal. It also helped the Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, win re-election by using this issue to outflank the far right and get his center-right party back into power. And ever since then, it has been at the forefront of Australia's debate, despite the fact that Australia is a very large country that's actually concerned with underpopulation and trying to bring in more people and has a very large annual net immigration of legal immigrants coming in with work visas and spouse visas and that sort of thing. But this small group of people arriving by boat and seeking asylum has turned into a major political issue, and they've been ostracized as illegal, despite the fact that there's nothing illegal about making an asylum claim. And they've been offshored to these horrible places in the middle of nowhere indefinitely. And then they're either pushed to repatriate voluntarily or to stay indefinitely waiting for an asylum claim to be processed in a country that they had never heard of when they left their own.
It's interesting because I lived in Hong Kong in the 70s. Mm. And I know in the lead up to the 1997 repatriation of Hong Kong to China, mm-hmm. that a large number of Hong Kong Chinese mm-hmm. moved to Australia or were mm-hmm. brought into Australia. And I think that there's been also a very large number of influx of other immigrants. And I don't know what the statistics are in Australia, yeah. but I think that they have adjusted and even, as you said, attracted a large number of immigrants yeah. on purpose, but what they were people with money or at least a certain base of money, like $10,000 or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's complicated and interesting about Australia is you can't argue that it's an anti-immigrant policy because hundreds of thousands of immigrants are coming every year. Their explanation, if you talk to Australian politicians, is that we want it to be orderly and we want to be in control of it, which is an understandable sentiment, but Canada has an orderly immigration policy as well, but it has a prime minister who goes to the airport and welcomes refugees who've just arrived from Syria. Australia sends them to remote Pacific islands. And it's a very small group of people. And what's really at the core of it is sort of the political use of the notion of illegal. You know, it's not illegal to claim asylum, but in the public mind in Australia, these people coming on boats, often fleeing war situations in their home countries, have been branded illegal. And people now believe in Australia that they are illegal maritime arrivals, is what they call them. And so once you sort of take on that vocabulary of illegality, it's very easy to ostracize people and sort of push them out of sight and out of mind. And that's what they've done very effectively. And I just worry what happens when other countries latch onto that model.
Is it at all based on the fact that they're Muslim?
A lot of them are Muslim, and that rhetoric was used for sure right after 9/11. But, you know, Australia has a lot of Sri Lankans, for instance, mm-hmm. Who they're trying to send back now because they say, oh, it's safe there again. So, yes, there are a huge number of Muslims, and now there's the Rohingya refugee crisis, which is going to eventually impact Australia because it's not that far away, and most of the potentially safe countries in between aren't signatories to the UN Refugee Convention. So even if they were able to lodge a claim and feel safe in Malaysia or in Thailand, they are not able to do that, and so they're going to move south, I would expect, and also towards Europe if this crisis gets worse. And then we're going to see this whole thing play out again.
We have time for a few more questions.
So going back to Syria and 2015, I mean, clearly there are a lot of really educated refugees leaving and who have a great love for their country. Have you heard of any kind of movement in Europe that they will be able to get some kind of a government going? Like I think after Persia, Iran, a lot of educated people also tried to create a political movement, hoping to...
A sort of government in exile?
Yes.
I don't have a good answer for that question. I know that there are a lot of Syrian dissident groups that whose leaders have gotten out, and quite a few of them are in Berlin now. There's some in this country. People who left fairly early, either because they were longstanding dissidents against the Assad regime and had been criticizing that regime for a long time. It's not a very well-organized, coherent movement, and there's a lot of infighting from what I've read. I don't see anything really cohesive, but there's certainly a lot of prominent intellectuals and freedom fighters who have left and are writing and mobilizing in Europe, but they're fairly small pockets. So, you know. Any other questions from anyone?
Kind of going back to what was said earlier about standing up to Trump, it seems to me that Angela Merkel, and I guess to a certain extent Emmanuel Macron, were able to really sort of stand up for doing the right thing without it costing them a lot of political capital.
Yes.
And yet you see people like Corker and Jeff Flake who are only feel able to stand up to the leader of their party when they're retiring. And Jeff Flake I actually had some hope for because initially he was making these statements before he announced that he was retiring. Why is there such a difference? And I know that's it's not
No, you're absolutely right. I admire them for speaking out, but it does seem that most of the harshest criticism within the Republican Party is coming from people who don't have any skin in the game or won't. And so I think that Merkel and Macron are models in some sense. I don't know if I mentioned in the talk, but in the final presidential debate in France, it was a really nasty, vicious debate where the moderator sort of just disappeared and they were yelling at each other, sitting across a table from each other. And he looked at Le Pen and he said, "You are the high priestess of fear sitting right here in front of me." And she sort of paused for a minute. And it was this moment, the way that any society has a presidential debate moment, and everyone was talking about it afterwards and quoting it. And he said in his acceptance speech after the election, you know, we can't cave into this fear. It's not who we are as a country. And so the question is that sort of rosy rhetoric the day after a victory or a sort of strategic move in a debate, or can he carry that forward? And I hope the answer is yes. I admired him for doing that. It didn't cost him votes, or maybe a few, but he won a convincing majority. Merkel lost some of her share in this election, but the interesting thing about Merkel is that most of her opponents were within her own party or in parties that had backed her on the refugee issue. So she lost some of her votes to this far-right party, but she also lost some voters to the Green Party, you know, to another center-right party. They had generally fallen in line, and so her toughest opposition politically was within her own party, and she had neutralized that already. So Merkel also deserves, apart from standing up on a moral level, she deserves a lot of credit for just being a very, very savvy political operator. And few people realize, because she's not a glamorous or exciting politician, and you know she doesn't give these rousing speeches like Obama did, but she manages to sideline her enemies in a way that's much more effective than anyone I see on the political stage anywhere.
To go a little bit further about Germany, maybe part of the issue there is that the Turkish workers, guest workers, have been there since the 60s, 70s, and people have gone through one wave of fear and then kind of partially gotten over it and said, this isn't really that devastating, because I have family in Germany as well. Mm-hmm. And they seem to have absorbed this large number of refugees and that everybody's been taken care of because they...
Yeah, Germany.
Furniture and clothing and all that. People have shared it, and you know you can't really buy used clothing and stuff like that. There's just so much available and all given away, that kind of thing. And there's really the market for it disappeared.
Yeah, Germany's interesting in that sense. I'm not sure it's because everyone just adjusted and was happy. I think there was a latent anger in a certain segment of the population that has now expressed itself in the AfD getting 13%. In the recent election. A lot of these people were people who didn't vote in the past, and or they were voting for really heinous far-right parties who were unreconstructed Nazis. And suddenly a party comes along that moderates its rhetoric a little bit, even though they do have plenty of unapologetic Nazi types within the party still. And they suddenly felt that they had permission. So the other thing about Germany that I think you have to take into account is that nostalgia for the World War II era and before is completely off limits for good reasons in German public debate. And that's not the case in places like France and Holland that haven't even fully reckoned with their histories in that era. And so what you see in with politicians like Le Pen and Wilders is a sort of European version of Make America Great Again, right? It's a politics fueled by nostalgia and this idea that we just go back to the 1950s and everything will be fine when we were white and pure, which is the subtext of what they're arguing. It's much harder for politicians to make that argument in Germany because of the history and because of how the country has dealt with that history. And so what you see instead is an attempt to say, well, people have legitimate grievances and they're upset about how their neighborhoods are changing. And that is a fair thing to raise, and politicians need to have that debate, and the left hasn't always had it very effectively. But it's much harder for a German politician, even on the far right, to talk about Germany in the 30s or 40s in a nostalgic way. And that has sidelined these voices for a long time. But now they're out there, and they're making arguments that could take Germany in a dangerous direction. They're just making it more carefully than their counterparts in other countries.
Time for one more question. Well, maybe we can go into one thing. If you've noticed anything in Trump's rhetoric, you mentioned the great recapture as like a code word that's used. There are some things in Trump's rhetoric that appeals to this nativist approach. And some of it is language like that, the great recapture, something that people don't really recognize if they haven't studied it. Is there any language like that that you've noticed?
I mean, there's a lot in Trump's rhetoric. He talks about, well, I mean, if you look at the campaign rhetoric about Mexican rapists, if you look at his targeting of judges both during the campaign and after the travel ban, coming out and saying if bad people and terrorists attack our country, it's the fault of these judges who halted my executive order. I mean, that's both an attack on the independence of the judiciary, but it's also very scary on another level because he's effectively blaming the system of checks and balances for not keeping the country safe. And if you throw that out, then he should be able to govern by executive order. I mean, that, you know, if you think a few steps ahead, and I'm not saying that's exactly what he had in mind, but if you care about upholding liberal democratic values and institutions, then that's very worrying rhetoric. And to their credit, people like McCain and Flake and Corker are speaking out about that sort of thing because I think they are genuine defenders of liberal democratic values, as much as I may disagree with them on other policy issues. I just wish that they wouldn't only do it when they didn't have skin in the game anymore.
Great. Well, thank you. Any last question? Great. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
And so ends another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 115-year history of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks.
Thanks.
You get to do the gavel.